It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 140. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
And I'm Keeper John. And in this episode, we talked to Mike Mason a few days ago about the Miskatonic Repository and all kinds of tips for beginning writers.
I'm Keeper Murphy. And yeah, that was a fun interview. We also ended up revisiting certain kleptomaniacal. That's not how you say that.
But we just keep rolling. So
going. So fudge. Ended up revisiting a certain kleptomaniacal monster.
And I'm Keeper Chad. And here's the crier portion that we recorded after the interview.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. Here's where we're going to go through Mythos-related news and feedback for the show. This crier portion is being recorded on March 8th, 2018.
First up, we have a pretty big apology to give. Back in late 2016, we switched our email, our feedback email, over from an old MU website address that wasn't actually working anymore to a Gmail account, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com. Due to a couple of tech glitches and a communication train wreck on our part, that address has gone unchecked since November of 2016. We recently discovered this, and to our complete and utter dismay, there were almost 40 unanswered feedback emails in that inbox. So to all of you that have sent something in, only to hear a resounding silence from us, we are very sorry. We have since contacted everyone that sent in an email, but if you think you've been overlooked, please contact us again and let us know.
Yeah, so here, this is the part where we put the fall on sword sound.
Yeah.
Basically, we thought it was working, but that we just weren't getting stuff sent in.
I just thought we just weren't getting emails.
Yeah. It's like a stalemate, but it involved, 40 people.
No big deal.
So among the items we completely missed the boat on, we're going through these emails, we're kind of culling, and we've seen a lot of great stuff, actually, some great feedback and stuff that kind of breaks our heart that we missed. But in any case, we are going to go back and talk about some of the stuff we missed the boat on. For one thing, from December 2017, Glenn emailed us to let us know about a Patreon for a Lovecraftian RPG that is currently in development. It's called Journey to the Tree of Sorrows. And it looks pretty good. And we're going to have a link in the show notes. Thank you very much, Glenn.
Also, a little more than a year ago, that's right, a year ago, RPG Coasters did a campaign to launch hardwood drink coasters themed specifically for the Cthulhu RPG. These are pretty cool. They include investigator professions like parapsychologist and antiquarian. So your game group can have each their own special little coaster for every party member. You can also have the text customized to say what you like. I actually just bought one of these, and mine is a Keeper coaster, and it will actually say Keeper Murph on it. And I'll send you all, I'll have a picture whenever it arrives.
Ooh, I want to get one.
They're pretty cool.
Yeah. They're really sweet.
Another boat that we missed was a nice bit of feedback from a blogger who runs Brawl of Cthulhu, where they have a blog post about each of the monsters in the Malleus Monstorum. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, these look great.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. Every single monster in Malleus is in there. It's crazy.
And there are a couple of news items related to the re-release of Masks of Nyarlathotep. First, the Masks expansion for Fantasy Flight Games Eldritch Horror is now out for general release, and we'll have a link to we'll post about that from Chaosium in the show notes. Also, Chaosium has announced that, see, they were going to release these at the same time. They're going to release the masks, revamp for 7th edition the same time as the Fantasy Flight Games deal, but that hasn't happened. And obviously we've had some, delays in the Masks of Nyarlathotep campaign. It was going to be available before the end of the year. That didn't happen. So they have announced now that it will be expected later in 2018. We don't have any more fresh information about that, but that is the situation with that campaign.
There's a new Kickstarter out for a game called Lovecraft Preparatory Academy, which seems to be a mashup of Lovecraft, Miskatonic University, and Harry Potter, of all things. You can get the game in PDF form for about $15 on the Kickstarter page, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well.
And we have our first director for the TV series that's on the way for Lovecraft Country. And so basically someone named Jan Damerge enters Lovecraft Country. Let's see. He is a British director that's set to direct and executive produce the first episode of HBO's straight-to-series drama Lovecraft Country from Jordan Peele. Freshly Oscar minted Jordan Peele and J.J. Abrams.
Nice. Oh, Bad Robot.
Bad Robot.
Bad Robot. And if I could do a quick aside, have you guys seen Get Out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was really late to the game in seeing that. I feel like it has a strong Lovecraftian touch to it as well.
So much. So much. I wanted it to win. Didn't win, but it won best screenplay, which
it
deserves.
We had a movie about a deep one romance that did win.
Yeah, that's
for crying out loud. By a man who wants to make mountains of madness.
Which he hopefully might be able to do now.
Freaking friend of the show, Matt Puccio, has released A Light in Darkness. It's a dark survival horror scenario for Call of Cthulhu 7th edition. It's set in the Pacific Theater, one of my favorites, during World War II. One of my favorite theaters of the two. I know, that was a weird thing to say.
Along with the Bijou, right?
What?
A Bijou theater. Characters, special purpose insanity cards and weapon cards, maps, and other player handouts designed to run in 4 to 5 hours for 3 to 6 players. Congratulations, Matt.
Yeah, and it's
pretty cool. I already bought it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I did too.
Me too.
I haven't had the time to read through it yet, but I purchased it.
Yeah, I got a nice early preview of it, and I love it. I think it's got some great, creepy. I mean, you just imagine Pacific Theater, just that feeling of being isolated and so highly recommend it. And I think Mike mentions it in the past interview, which we will be playing soon.
Oh.
It was number one for a while. It was like the hottest scenario when it dropped, you know.
And for some feedback here from our dear friend Graham, he mentioned that there's a novel series of 2 books at the moment by an author named DJ Beldrock on Amazon called Ascendant Untempered, and that the plot line is ripe for a superhero Cthulhu mythos mashup. The superheroes draw their powers from non-Euclidean entities but don't know it.
Nice.
And he says that the author may be a bit too enamored of zombies for his taste. Both novels have them featured in there, but they are at least kind of an interesting variation on type. But I just love the idea that the superheroes are mythos powered and don't know it yet.
Yeah.
That guy's name is DJ Baldock, by the way, just so we can clear that.
Oh, what did I say?
There was an R. You added an R. In the show notes, and you guys can pronounce it for yourselves. So.
Yeah.
Baldock.
Answering the call for audio segments, very much appreciated. Max has sent in a little teaser for something that isn't fully ready yet, but we're going to hear a little taste of something we'll play right now.
Coming
Coming soon from the Miskatonic University Department of Theater. An original radio drama created for WMUP. Occult Occurrences, starring Chet Wallace, P.I. New case, Old Gods.
That's awesome!
Right?
Oh.
That's awesome.
Oh, oh wow.
My favorite part is P.I.
I like new case, old gods.
Oh, Max, we love you. That is awesome.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, it's going to be good. All right, I'm going to play the bumper.
Please.
Hi, I'm Paul Fricker.
I'm Scott Norwood.
And I'm Matt Sanderson.
And together we are known as...
The good friends of Jackson Elias.
And we only have one thing to say to you.
Go,
Pops!
That's
awesome.
Look, they could synchronize, John. What's the problem?
That's true. They're in the same location. It was a shed. Now they're in a house. All right. They're in the same location.
Excuses. Hey, this is a quick little extra note to thank Edwin for editing the following interview with Mike. And just so you know, due to an audio issue, we had to resort to the Google Hangouts backup recording. So thanks again to Edwin, credit where credit is due, for a stellar job and for doing the best you could given the quirks of Hangouts and internet voice communication. Now back to our regularly scheduled program.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
Now that we're into the main topic, Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good.
Doing great.
Hey, Mike.
Welcome.
Hiya. Good to be here. Thanks, as always.
I believe the last time we had you on our airways, we were all in Providence. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be right. Yes. Yes. Necronomicon.
Yeah, we'll say all. We'll say all. Not all, but we'll say all.
An effigy of you was present.
If you want to go there, that's fine. Well, we did go there. That's the problem.
We all went there. So we were thinking today that we would talk a bit about a pretty major development, at least for the community of Call of Cthulhu, which is that there is now a space to post content of your own, you know, put it out in the world and see who salutes it. Mike, would you talk a little bit about the Miskatonic repository?
Sure. Yeah. Well, Miskatonic University repository.
Yeah. Okay.
Is a sub store to the Chaosium store on DriveThruRPG. It's basically a collection of user made content. So that means anyone can write and produce a Call of Cthulhu scenario or some material for, playing with the game and, upload it to DriveThru. Obviously you need to set up an account and what the repository does is allows you to, basically set the price for the product you've created. You own the product effectively. So you can make it available for free. You can, set whatever price, I think you can even set a pay what you like price, I believe, as well. You upload a finished PDF and then it goes live when you wish. And then anyone else, can then, purchase, at whatever price you set the piece for, download it and then, use it in their games. Most notably, the majority of items on here are going to be things like, you know, scenarios, but, you know, there are also props and, play aids as well. And what we've tried to do is put a number of play aids on there. So there are collections of forms and in-game props. We've also put up collections of, imagery, photographs and artwork, but which are free, which people can download and then actually use those in their own scenarios. Cause obviously if you've written a scenario, you may not necessarily be an artist or that kind of thing. And so having access to a range of different art that we've freely provided for this purpose, allows people to kind of, make their PDFs a little bit more attractive and lay them out in that regard. And in terms of layout, we've provided a Word template for people to kind of, drop their scenarios into again. So it looks nice, so it follows a kind of a standard format. And there's also, I believe, an InDesign version of the same template for those who are a little bit more perhaps proficient with layout to use as well. So what we've tried to do is provide the tools and some resources for people who are writing their own scenarios and want to share them, with everyone else. And, role playing is one of those hobbies where, whilst yes, you can just play the game with published scenarios and material that already exists and you don't have to create anything yourself. Most, 99% of role players at some time will get into the idea of actually designing their own scenarios, designing their own kind of support materials. And so it's, it's very natural for role players to want to produce stuff. And so having an avenue to do this, hopefully, fits that need and also means that, you can share your work with other people whilst at the same time, getting it, making a little bit from it. So it's not, you get a little bit of a return. And as with anything, the market decides. So if your scenario becomes very popular, hopefully, you may earn a little bit more, that's great. And obviously in terms of the way the finances work, I think the creator of the content, they get 50% of any, proceeds. And then the remaining 50% is split between DriveThruRPG as the, the hosting site and Chaosium as the owner and licensor of Call of Cthulhu. So there's no paperwork you've got to fill in. You just agree to the terms as use the sub store in DriveThruRPG. That's in a nutshell.
Yeah,
kind of what it is. Yeah,
fantastic. And it's just been quite a lot of response already. You launched with a few pieces already kind of in the works, so that there was material ready to go when it came out.
Yeah, but like the last thing you want to do is open a store and have nothing in on the shelves, do you?
Mm-hmm. Fair point.
Pretty much. So we
worst grand opening ever.
Yeah. So we worked with a few people who we knew had a few things in the works, and offered, said we'd really like to get some material on there to start and they've obviously jumped at the chance, and we got some great stuff on there from a number of different authors. Some existing authors, some new authors. And that's what's really cool. It's a real mix of people. I think Adam Gauntlet, who's a published author, has put some material on there. Joe Trier from the Harry Roll podcast has worked with Stephanie to put out, I think, The Idol of Toth. And there's, but there's many other scenarios and things up there now. It's starting to, build up a range of content that, as you would expect from a community-based resource is, very wide, far-reaching and diverse, which is, exactly what you'd want. So give everyone lots of choice to kind of, pick and choose what they need. If you need an adventure tonight and you haven't got one ready, you could hopefully download a short one shot from here and go with it perhaps.
Yeah. And this, I think people who have been around for a little bit remember the monograph system. It's not that long ago. This seems to sort of fill that niche, but in a very different way, where you have sort of fan and beginner created content, place to put it. What was Chaosium's thinking? What was the idea here? What does Chaosium get from having such a community?
for whatever ills or boons the Moolah scheme did, the Miskatonic Library Association books, you know, that had no kind of editorial oversight or development really from Chaosium. They were effectively fan producers, just that Chaosium would then actually put them out. They were obviously a mixed bag, but they did require Chaosium to do some work. We had to actually take the text and then produce something from it. And we just don't have the time to do that kind of thing these days, what with, you know, with the kind of the re-gearing of the company and, you know, getting our a series of books out ourselves. You know, all our time is focused on producing and publishing, you know, Chaosium's, Call of Cthulhu books and whatnot. So we don't really have a time, you know, we don't really have the time anymore to kind of, support that kind of, fan end of the publishing spectrum. But we wanted to support it. We wanted to have a space for it to flourish and to develop. And so, you know, since, you know, the days of the Moolahs, obviously things like drive-through RPG have come along and they present a very easy and very accessible way for people to do this. So we, you know, we've taken advantage of that to do this. It's a different way of doing it. As you say, it's a lot easier. You know, you just have to write something, make it presentable and upload it. You know, and you are the owners and we don't have to, you know, effectively be involved. We can just, you know, look at the benefits, with everyone else in terms of the publication of the material. Obviously we get a small fee from things, but as you can imagine, we're not talking, you know, a lot of money here. Obviously most of the items are available for like $1 or $1.99. So we're talking a few cents per sold. So we're not going to get rich off this, but it just, you know, supports the, you know, what, administration and time we have to spend in terms of, you know, supporting the repository, et cetera. But really it's about, you know, it's about enabling, writers to develop content and particularly, you know, for new writers to get that, you know, first foot in the door and, get themselves and their work into other people's hands and played. And obviously in terms of, you know, from my perspective, that allows me to kind of keep an eye on potential new writers coming forward who, you know, are showing some promise and, who down the line, you know, maybe the future kind of, writers of, you know, official Call of Cthulhu products down the line, you know, so it's a great way of getting noticed. It's a great way of developing your skills. It's a great way of getting feedback. And basically, you know, if you want to be a writer for RPGs, it's a very low bar to just getting yourself out there. There's no one telling you you can't do it. There's no editor. There's no anyone else. It's just, you know, if you want to get something out there, you can just do it. And you do it, you know, not just into the labyrinth of the internet where you could maybe publish something online, from your website, but most people are not going to know that it exists. Whereas this is a central focal point, means that your work will be seen. You know, you've got the backing of a big, you know, player in terms of the RPG industry and in terms of the game itself. You've got that publicity already built in. So you're by supporting the Call of Cthulhu line by writing for it and publishing through the MU repository, you're equally getting the return of the publicity and the ease of access that comes with, you know, writing for Call of Cthulhu in that sense, if that kind of makes some sort of sense, I guess. But, you know, ultimately it's about, you know, encouraging new writers, encouraging writers and artists and designers, as well. And I guess, you know, the kind of the secondary, but equally valid is that sense of community that it's developing as well. You know, it becoming I guess you might see it as a focal point for the wider Call of Cthulhu community.
I had a question, Mike. So it sounds like that the way that this has been set up is that a creator could access the template, put something together, and then have it submitted up into drive-through RPG to be displayed and available for purchase. Does that completely circumvent any kind of editorial review or anything that Chaosium may or may not want to do? Is there anything that could be put up that you guys might, in hindsight, go, ooh, that's not really the way that we'd like to see that creature displayed, or that's, you know, I don't know. Is there any downfall to not having, or does Chaosium get to put a thumbs up or thumbs down on anything that's submitted for the repository before it gets put onto the into the store?
Well, there are guidelines, and before you upload anything, you should obviously ensure that you read the guidelines that are there for uploading material to the repository. Some very clear and simple guidelines that you can follow. Obviously, if you don't follow the guidelines, then whatever material you put up may get taken down. Obviously, Chaosium is the owner of the store, and you know, at the end of the day, we do get to say what goes on the shelves. And if there was something that deviated from the guidelines, then obviously we're within our kind of rights to kind of have a word with the author and hopefully get that addressed, so we don't have to kind of, you know, take it down from the store. But obviously, ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, and it's anything that would make sense in real life, you know. So, you know, we're not looking to have material that would be, you know, contravene any laws that would, you know, be problematic in terms of racism and other issues, you know, along that theme and others, you know, just, you know, what would be acceptable in any, you know, published material from any, you know, respectable company. So there are some guidelines about that kind of stuff. But that's all within the context. And I mean, you know, but ultimately, you know, we don't vet anything that goes up before it goes up. What we have said is obviously we keep an eye on it. And, you know, when things go up, we'll get around to having a look at it. But we do expect, you know, we kind of expect the community will help to police the whole thing anyway. So should something questionable or downright offensive be put up there, obviously, you know, normally we can count on the community to be pretty quick in terms of telling us where things are good and bad. If we haven't spotted it ourselves and the community points something out, or somebody does to say that, you know, they've got a question about a piece of material that's gone up, then obviously we will look at that and make a call on whether we feel it's contravened any guidelines or not. And again, have a word with the author. But at the end of the day, if it does, and you know, the author isn't willing to address any particular issues that may have arise, then obviously we do have the ability to turn it off the store, you know. So that's ultimately the thing. So but you know, we've certainly not encountered anything like that so far. You know, just, you know, understanding, you know, what would be, you know, what would, if it would be acceptable in, you know, when you open the next Chaosium collection of scenarios, then it would probably be acceptable on the repository. If you open a book and you were kind of like, oh wow, that's very offensive, then it's probably going to be very offensive and therefore probably not something you'd want on the repository. That's, you know, that's as with anything in life. But ultimately, no, we don't set a bar in that respect, other than the guidelines and stipulations that are in the kind of, you know, the material when you sign up to the repository. You know, but we will keep an eye on things, and I certainly keep an eye on things by, you know, because I want to keep an eye on, you know, if there's some new writer I've never heard of who's doing some really good stuff, then, you know, that's worth knowing, isn't it?
Is Chaosium able to collect metrics or stats, as it were, on?
Well, we can see we can see what's, you know, what's selling, you know, the best, or what's being downloaded the most in terms of volumes. But obviously at the moment it's still pretty early days. So a lot of the things that have been downloaded the most are actually the things we've put up for free, like the image packs and things like that, which obviously everyone's just downloaded because they can. So it's going to take some time before the real content, as it were, the actual user content, starts to kind of show. We start to see some kind of, leveling of how that actually, you know, which scenarios are kind of doing better than others, get a feel for that. But obviously, you know, the drive through itself kind of helps you to do that with anyone can see. If you open the store now, you know, it'll tell you what the hottest titles are in the store are. And that's, I mean, not that I know precisely, but I'm guessing that is completely based on the number of sales and downloads. So if you look down at the minute, then number one is A Light in the Darkness by, Matthew,
number one.
Yeah.
Hey.
So I mean, that's also the most recent one that's gone up. So obviously newer stuff tends to be, you know, everyone downloads it because it's new. You know, that will flux and change, you know, on a daily, weekly basis. But, you know, and also obviously that, you know, users can rate the material. So you can see that, some will have 5 stars, some have no stars yet because no one's reviewed them. And, you know, that kind of usual kind of leveling that happens with any kind of community, range of products. But it's all very exciting and great. We've got some really good stuff up there at the moment. And, you know, it's, what I really like is the creativity and the diversity of the material. And, that's only going to grow. I mean, you know, you've got the stuff, like The Scales of Time by Michael Nagel, who's put up a couple of books, and they're not just single scenarios. They're kind of like full on, almost like supplements with all sorts of stuff, which are basically his kind of collected works, you know, that have, you know, come from his gaming table over the years. He's basically over time kind of collected together, put in some kind of, you know, format and sense. And you've got adventures and bits of material of all sorts going on there. And, you know, and actually a mini campaign from that to, you know, single one shots like, The Idol of Toth, which is, I think Joe wrote it as a kind of a, you know, it's a one shot, but he also wrote it in mind that it could be used as an introductory scenario. So, you know, you've got a real range of things starting to develop already, even though it's only a few months old.
So would you guys ever consider printing actual physical print of any of these scenarios that are up here in the Miskatonic Grids repository?
I'm not sure what the situation, I mean, we wouldn't necessarily ourselves, because, if we're going to go to the expense of that, then we would want to do a full proper production with artwork and et cetera, and fully edited version. Which, you know, maybe that down the line there are certain scenarios that stand out. I think actually that's a really cool scenario. If we work with the author to develop it a little bit more, then maybe we might do it like an enhanced version in the scenario collection potentially. I'm not sure what the ins and outs are with drive through, whether we can turn on a pod facility or not. I don't know generally, but if that is an option, I'm sure that's something we can start to explore down the line. If that's something that people want, if there's an ability to either buy the PDF or to do a pod, print version, you know, directly through drive through, then that would obviously be the sensible solution. Because, you know, that's just, you know, works on the print on demand structure would work very well, which, you know, we don't have to get involved in. So we don't have to, you know, delay things or, you know, muck around. We can, you know, can just become automated, which is obviously means that stuff happens quicker and people get what they want. But I don't know the inside. I'm not that heavily involved in the background of the MUR. I'm just kind of, I just benefit from it like everyone else, you know, in that sense of, you know, I look at the stuff and pick out what's cool and look for new writers and artists and whatnot from it. And, but I don't really get involved in the day-to-day admin side of it. I've got enough to do, to be honest, I've got enough to do producing Call of Cthulhu books, which I'm sure is a far better use of my time.
And when you say pod, you're talking for those uninitiated, you're talking about print on demand, or are you talking about aliens who are taking over?
Well, both. Really?
Okay.
Mainly print on demand.
I'd like that option, for aliens to, yeah, maybe help us with our publishing business.
Or that when you download one, by downloading it, you are extra dimensionally having an alien take you over.
I do believe that there is a subspecies of Shan that allow you to work in the printing industry in general. So
yeah,
I get it.
Mike, did you have any personal hopes on the types of things that the repository could develop into?
I'd just like to see a wide and diverse collection of cool stuff to do at your gaming table that enhances, supports, and also expands the kind of, you know, what we're able to do in terms of the main, you know, Call of Cthulhu line. Because obviously, you know, we're limited in the fact that you can, you know, whilst we want to produce as many books as we can and get them all out tomorrow, you know, it takes time and resource, and that's a finite amount in a very small company like Chaosium. So the repository allows, you know, more material to get out there much more quickly than we would be able to do ourselves. And in terms of what I'm looking for, I'm looking for the next artist, writer, cartographer, that, you know, who have the potential and skills to be, you know, published, you know, in our core books. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a cool gaslight scenario that, because I'm running a gaslight campaign and I haven't prepared something and I haven't got time to write something, and I can just go to the repository and look for gaslight and find, oh yeah, I'm going to use that one. I shall read it and I shall use that one. Or it may be the next pulp scenario. It might be the next, down darker trail scenario. I don't know. That's what I want to use it for. Just like, I guess, like many other people do. Ultimately, you know, at the core of it, what I'm looking for is, you know, I think it's a great way to get known as a writer. I mean, it would have been cool if this existed when I was starting out. Because I mean, this is just, you could write a scenario that's 4 pages long, as long as it's understandable, and put it up there. You know, whereas the Library Association books, the Moolahs, you kind of needed to write a whole book to make that work, which for a new writer is, you know, fairly big and daunting exercise, where it's just writing a short scenario, one shot, you know, that you can just upload as a PDF, is a lot more accessible now than it used to be through the MUR. And so, you know, yeah, and you set a price. I mean, you can even say, okay, well, I'm just going to set a dollar for this, or 50 cents or whatever it may be, just to see if people like it, you know, and, you know, is it any good? Get some feedback. And if everyone comes back and said, that's really good, why don't you do some more? Then hopefully that's a bit of encouragement as well for you to do some more. If you don't sell many, you get some negative feedback, then maybe you get a chance to kind of evaluate it and think, well, okay, how do I improve? How do I make this better? How do I learn from this? How do I, you know, can I speak to some people who've played it, get some people to give me some feedback? You know, you can use the Chaosium BRP Central forums for Call of Cthulhu, or the Cult of Chaos forums, if you're a member, to get, you know, elicit some more feedback and play testing. I mean, that's, you know, it's, as I said before, it's another tool of the wider community to develop your game, basically. And so I think it fits hand in hand with the Cult of Chaos. It fits hand in hand with the forums, and sits very nicely alongside, you know, what, you know, are the Chaosium Dome products in that sense.
It strips a lot of the risk for the writer, as far as putting a whole bunch of work into something that may never, get to print. There's also strips some of the financial risk if you wanted to kickstart something yourself, we've seen, you know, a lot of, people have trouble with that. It's a big undertaking. You sort of have to be part business person at least. So this is kind of an easier entry, it seems like.
Well, this is it. I mean, the thing is, Kickstarter, most people underestimate the amount of work that is required in a Kickstarter. Oh, I've written a scenario, I can put it out as a book. And, you know, we've seen some people do it successfully. We've seen some people do it less successfully. And we're still waiting on some people to finish doing it. It's a mixed bag, and no one knows. Even you as yourself, if you've never done a Kickstarter before and you go with it, you don't know whether it's going to turn out rosy or not, because 101 things can happen. It's not just about the writing. It's also about the layout. It's also about the art. It's also about the production. It's also about the shipping. It's also about customer relations, and all of that, as well as everything else. Whereas the MUR is just about writing and making it look pretty so you can turn it into a PDF and upload it.
Yeah,
it doesn't involve anyone else. It involves only you. And that, so if it's only you, you can control things a lot more easily and better.
I think that's a good point to make, because even established companies can completely hose up a Kickstarter, just even one that was highly successful, like Palladium, just with the Royal Attack.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should know. I've seen it for myself.
I thought that's where you're going, Murph. I was like, oh, okay.
No, I wasn't going there.
It's not a low risk environment.
No, it's not. And I think that's what a lot of people misunderstand about Kickstarter, but we've had this conversation a million and a half times. So yeah. I don't think we need to go into it.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And that's all I was trying to say is I think, you know, if, you know, the repository, there is no risk from it. You put up what you wish to put up. You follow the guidelines. You should have no problems. You set your own price. You can change the price. If you think you've set something too high, or you want to sell it for free or nothing for a month and just get it out there and then change the price, I think you can obviously do that as the content owner. It's your thing. And if you want to stop selling it, you turn it off. You know, and that's down to you, because, you know, it's your content. You know, Chasm doesn't own your content. If we want to approach you and say, hey, we really like that scenario, we think it would work really well in a new book, could we work with you to develop it? Then obviously then we will enter in some sort of arrangement, and we would look to, you know, renumerate you appropriately, because it's your content. We're not going to just go and print it without your say so. It's a secure in that sense. It's risk free. And it's about, you know, getting your stuff out there, which is what it's all about at the end of the day. Getting, you know, and ultimately it's about people using your material and, or just taking other people's material and having fun with it in the game that's called Call of Cthulhu.
Right. So, and with this door now open for so many new writers to have a go, do you have any advice for people who are just doing their first stuff, or, you know, how to make it the best it can be?
Sure. I mean, again, I think I've put together some advice that kind of has been used within some of the actual guidelines for the repository. So please do make sure you look at those. But I mean, ultimately, there's, you know, the biggest advice I can give to anyone who is a potential writer for a Call of Cthulhu scenario who wanted to put up on the repository is to write it. Because, most people don't write it. They talk about writing it and never do. But if you actually write it, then you are, you know, 90% ahead of everyone else because you've actually written it. Then really the advice is to, you know, to try and be as professional as you can in terms of your approach to the material. So that would be, you know, playtest it, be prepared to develop and change it based on the playtesting. Ideally give it to somebody else to playtest. And so, you know, they read it. Can they understand it? Do they understand your intentions through the scenario? Have you described them adequately, in the actual text? Did they have a good game with it? You know, did they have any problems? Take their feedback on board and develop the scenario a little bit more. And then ultimately, you know, make it look, you know, reasonably attractive in terms of, you know, clean and usable. Use the resources that are freely available on the thing. You know, if you've got some deep ones in there, then there's a deep one silhouette and maybe some different art that you can just download for free from the repository and to just, you know, to just prettify the scenario up a little bit, perhaps make it a little bit more visually appealing. Just treat it, you know, try and be as professional as you can without necessarily going overboard. Cause at the end of the day, what's more important is making it usable, clean and, you know, a good scenario, you know, a good tight scenario that does what it's meant to do. So that's really my advice. But number one is don't talk about it. Do it.
That's great advice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one that's easy to forget and get caught up in sort of, the ideas and making notes and making plans. I certainly am guilty there.
Yeah.
I think we all are to some extent.
I could foresee, I know I kind of faced this myself when I was starting to, try and become a writer. But Mike, is there any kind of, resources that you might be able to point a beginning writer to, maybe just to kind of start understanding what the craft itself is like, beyond just, you know, writing for the repository, but formulate a scenario? Because it's different from writing a short story.
Number one is read, know your subject. I don't mean know your rule book. I mean, know your subject. So if you run a writer scenario for a particular game, be it Call of Cthulhu or any other game, read some scenarios for that game. But in particularly, read scenarios that have been published within the last 12 to 24 months, because it's no good reading scenarios that were written 30 years ago, because they do not look like scenarios that are written for a contemporary audience. They are written differently. They served, for the most part, served slightly different purposes, or that gameplay was slightly different 30 years ago than it is today, believe it or not. And so read something current. Look at how those scenarios were put together. How are they structured? You know, Call of Cthulhu scenarios has this constant paradox, because often in a kind of a sandbox style scenario, you have a set of locations, you have a set of characters, and you have a set of events. And you have to decide, how do you place those three distinct sections in the scenario? Do you present them separately as three sections? So you start off with the characters and then the locations, and then here's some events you throw in. Do you start off with the locations and put the characters into the locations where they're most likely to be, and then put the events, or do you put them all, mix them all up together? There is no answer to this, but I'm just showing you a kind of classic issue with how do you structure a scenario. And so if you're unsure of what to do, look at some that exist already and see how they did it. You know, Doors to Darkness is a great example of this. You've got five scenarios, all written slightly differently, structured slightly differently, but do on a whole follow a similar format. So that would be a good start thinking, well, how do I turn my scenario into something that looks like a scenario out of Doors to Darkness? Well, the way you start by doing that is reading Doors to Darkness and dissecting the scenarios and looking at how have they structured them. So that would be one way, you know, the very kind of, you know, sharp end of the focus. But in terms of general writing, you know, there are millions of books on writing out there, but you know, look for ones that appeal to you. I mean, Stephen King's On Writing.
Yes.
Great book to read. In fact, his book on horror, The Dance Macabre, is just a generally good book as well. There's a really good book that I can't remember the name of. It's about on writing comics, which again has some real just good general tips, for general writing.
Is that the one by Alan Moore?
Not the one by Alan Moore. No, it's an American author. You know, I just can't remember it off the top of my head, but I'm trying to look at it on the shelf and I can't see it to shout it out to you, but I'll try and dig it out and let you know which one I mean. Sure. You know, there's 101 books. I mean, you know, of a good rule of thumb is if you've never heard of the person writing it, you then need to decide whether you feel that it's useful. If it's somebody you know is a very successful author and they're right telling you how they go about writing, then my gut would tell me that they probably know what they're doing because they're a successful author telling you this. But you know, it's not to discount anyone else, but you know, if you're on a budget and you're not sure who to buy, then maybe go for one people that you know you've heard of, at least to start with. But there are certainly some great books written by people who are very good at writing about writing that necessarily you may not have heard of in that sense, but there's not, yeah, that kind of stuff is all worth doing. But equally, you know, the easy stuff apart from reading about writing is talking to people, sharing your work with them, getting other people to run your games without you, because you are the worst person to run your own game, because you know what should happen. Mm-hmm. But what you want to do is make sure that somebody who isn't you knows what should happen. And that's based on what you write, not what's in your head and what you ad lib on the gaming table. That's often the biggest pitfall is that, you know, yeah, you've written that there's a room here with a trap at the end of it and a whatever. And that's all it says on the page. But you know that when you play it, what you have happen is that, you know, when anyone walks through the door, you have a spider fall on them and that causes this to happen and then that to happen. But you haven't actually written that in the scenario because you just know that that's what happens because that's what you do when you run the game. So the trick is to ensure that what you think should happen in the scenario is actually written down. And the only way to really check that is to get somebody else to read it and run it. And maybe you sit in and don't play and you just watch and listen to the game being played. So when you get to that room and the GM doesn't have a spider jump on somebody's shoulder and you think, so, well, why didn't they do that? And you look at the scenario that you're following along in your hand and realize I never actually wrote that in. It's just something I do when I run the game. I see that lots and lots of times when I'm reading it and going like, I'm sure there's a better scenario here because it feels like there is, but it's not actually written down. There's something missing. And so I often have to go back to writers and say, like, I think there's something missing in this scene. I think that, you know, what do you normally do when you run it? And they'll say, oh, I have a spider drop down. Oh, well, there you go then. Well, why didn't you put that in? Because that would really make sense. And then that would really bring the scene together.
That's funny. Yeah, that's a very funny particular problem of scenario or game writing, right? When you're doing fiction, it's all, if it's not on the page, you kind of know it. You know what's on the page. You're reading it. You know that there's only one linear way to experience this thing. Whereas, there's all kinds of things that can be in your head to make a great game that doesn't make it to the page.
Absolutely. And remember, when you're writing a scenario, you're not writing a short story or a novel. You are writing a set of guidance for another group of people who you probably will never meet to have fun with around a gaming table. So you need to make sure that your content, your gaming content, is player focused. You know, that it gives the players something to do, that you're not just spending six pages on the backstory for the keeper that the players will never ever know anything about. Because you may as well take that out, cut that, and then go write a short story with that, because that's what that is. What you want is actually content that is actually happens at the gaming table. So stuff that interacts with the player characters that's on camera. It's fine that there are a few asides say, oh, why are they doing this? This is happening in the background that they're not aware of. That's cool. That's just plot and narration. But, you know, 8 pages of backstory about something that happened in ancient Egypt when you've got a scenario that's in the 1920s Chicago, doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I can understand the narrative sense, and I can understand the need to wanting to understand your own backstory and to write that out.
But that's a second scenario, though.
That's either another scenario or a short story, and it's fine to do it. But what the trick is to understand when you don't actually need it in the final scenario. When actually one sentence or one paragraph to just summarize those 8 pages is actually all the keeper needs, because they're never going to use it. It's just a bit of info for them to know that this box that's in 1920 Chicago was first appeared in ancient Egypt. Well, that's all I actually need to say. It first appeared in ancient Egypt, and now it's in Chicago. Let's move on, you know.
So do you have any editor pet peeves that come up, whether it's with looking at beginner guys or if it's established authors?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, I think if you're gonna write for Call of Cthulhu, then you know having a reasonable understanding of the rules you're writing for is helpful. Understanding that it's about actually the focus is all about the players, not you as a writer. It's the players that are important because they're the ones that ultimately going to make it success of your scenario or not. But not really any peeves as such. No, I mean I think there's kind of thematic peeves, as in things. I only tend to get peeved about things thematically is when I feel that they are being overused a little bit. So, you know, my biggest peeve is, I really like the King in Yellow. I really like the whole Carcosa thing. I really like the Hasta stuff, but it is very, very popular. It has been very popular and continues to be very popular at this time. So I get peeved when, because it's such a broad and immersive kind of topic thematically, I get peeved when I see a scenario that's just really a rehash of what already exists. So, you know, oh, the scenario is about a play that a group of people are doing and the play turns out to be the King in Yellow. Ha ha, horror. Well, that's already been written and it's been written really well. And you can just go and play it. I don't need another scenario writing along that, but something a tangent to that or something sparking off that that's not quite the same is interesting, you know. So maybe it's not the play itself, but the actual pages of the play, that particular copy has had something happen to it, would be a slightly different take. And I'd be kind of more interested in that. But if it's just a case of, oh, there's a group putting on the King in Yellow and when everyone goes to see it, they're all going to go mad. Well, that's cool. It's a cool idea, but it has already been done not just once, but numerous times. And so I get a bit kind of peeved if it's like, you know, try and come up with your own angle. That's what I'm after. That's what interests me. It's your angle on it. What are you doing different? What are you doing to expand it? What are you doing to take it in a slightly different direction? What are you doing that's absolutely wacky and crazy off the wall and will make us all go, wow, that never saw that coming. That's awesome. You know, just be a little different. You know, take some of these common themes and twist them. I love to see people taking a straightforward common theme that we all expect that, oh, it's deep ones again, and twisting it and doing something actually crazy in left field with it that is going to be a surprise for everyone or horrify them or delight them or whatever it would be. That's my peeve, is when you've got really good material and you've not really embraced it fully and taken, you know, and done something cool with it, you know. But we're all, I say this, you know, but we're all guilty of the same. We all do the same things. But, you know, so it's equally a peeve about myself. You know, I want to push myself, just like I want to push other people to do different and innovative stuff. But that's the same, I think, for any writer. You're always very self-critical. You're also, you know, you look back and go, oh, I should have done that. I should have done that instead. I should have changed this here. And, you know, as an editor, I'm just more conscious of it because I see a lot of other people's work rather than just my own or a few things I've read in published things, you know. So it just becomes a bit more apparent to me, I guess.
If you were to identify something you kind of want to see more of, it's seeing reinvention and twisting. And I mean, that's what gets you excited when you look at a pitch.
Yeah. I'm a bit old fashioned in that, you know, I like to see somebody who's made an effort. You know, I like the fact that if somebody's, you know, made the effort to make, you know, to, you know, try and at least use the spell correct. I mean, it's not hard in Word. It tells you on the screen, this word is incorrectly spelt.
Yeah, right.
So if you, I like the fact that
artistic
someone.
Artistic interpretation of the word.
Well, I like the fact that, you know, I understand you need to, when you write, sometimes you just ignore and you need to just write it all out there before you then, you know, look at it again. So I like people who have been professional enough to have done that, but then have gone, well, I'm now just going to read it for errors and just going to try and make it as clean as I can, because that shows me a level of professionalism. The person is prepared to invest in their own work because they are expecting me to do that for them. So I kind of expect to meet halfway that, you know, you're going to at least have the, you know, the professionalism to want your work to be as clean as possible before it even gets to an editor. I think that's, you know, I think I'm old fashioned that way. So that impresses me if people have clearly made an effort.
Do you, just as a morbid curiosity on my part more than anything, does that come up a lot where you end up with someone who submits and it's obviously like almost a first draft?
I can tell the difference between somebody who writes a first draft. No, you know, I can't say I hand on heart can do this, but I feel, if it's a first draft and somebody's written a first draft and then just sent it in, really have kind of gone, I've done this. What do you think? It's normally pretty easy to see that that is what they've just done, is written that first draft, not looked at it again, really, and not kind of honed it in any way and just sent it in for some, you know, to have a look at, to ones of people who have actually spent some time on their own work, made it as attractive as possible and easy to read, and error free. You can normally tell the difference, pretty quickly. And you can also tell the difference between people who have taken time to actually read around their subject matter. that they haven't just picked up the rule book, let's say, and read that and gone like, this is really cool. I want to write scenarios for it, which, you know, that's great because hopefully that's what a rule book should do, help, you know, make, inspire you to do stuff. But then haven't really read anything else or played much of the game because you get, you will get some scenarios that come in that basically, I can see this is an original idea from yourself. I'm not, you know, it's not plagiarizing, but basically you've just rewritten The Haunting or something like that because clearly you've never played or read The Haunting. And that's cool. You know, that's fine. But obviously if you, you know, if you're intending to be more than just a fan producer of content and actually want to become a published writer of content, then obviously, you know, reading around your subject is only going to improve your, you know, your ability to do that, hopefully. So that's not really a peeve, that's more advice, I think. But does that answer the question?
Yeah, I mean, I was asking, you see a lot of those come through.
Not lots and lots. Once in a while. Most of the time, I'm happy to say most people, you know, do take a bit of an effort with their work, which is, you know, which is good. It reflects well on the community. Because I think, you know, one of the things I like about Call of Cthulhu is the community that goes with it is what I would term, an enthusiastic, mature in terms of outlook and supportive and inclusive. I think, you know, that's one of the things I like about the Call of Cthulhu community that I've always liked. And it's one of the reasons why I continue to play the game. Whereas some other games I've played, I don't feel the community has been quite the same or had the same kind of outlook. And often it's kind of like, well, what's my outlook? I want to play with people that have similar outlooks to me because that's just life. Whereas I play some of the games where the game is, you know, it serves a different purpose, I guess. And so the outlook it attracts is slightly different and it doesn't quite, you know, I'm happy to play it once or twice, but it doesn't really fulfill what I'm looking for in a game. So, you know, I think communities matter in that sense that they help to shape the game and they help to shape the experience of the game, be it on the page or at the gaming table.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the community helped produce, like yogg-sothoth.com, the Good Friends of Jackson Elias, and of course the Miskatonic University podcast. So.
Yeah, we
love the community.
I mean, you are living, breathing examples of the community because you didn't all start out as published writers. You started out as a group of players that wanted to actually, you know, talk about the game and explore the game further. And so you put that together in a podcast, and through that process, you know, you've all developed in terms of your writing, your contributions, your development, whether it's playing games, running games, writing stuff, putting people together, building community, yeah, just answering questions, just teaching people how to play the game or offering opinions is all about that community building. So, I mean, you know, you are living, breathing examples of a very positive way that people do that in the Call of Cthulhu community. So well done.
I thought we'd pull this back and keeping in the writer theme somewhat, but we've been talking about monsters over a few different episodes going back a ways that are kind of tough, that we find that are hard to approach for one reason or another, and wanted to know do you see some problematic monsters that you think are tough nuts to crack for some reason?
Yeah, I think there are some problematic monsters in the fact that they tend to be portrayed in only one way. And I think if I was just before I tell you the monster I'm thinking of, to sum it up, I think often because, you know, lack of space and just, you know, the way things are, that monsters often get portrayed in one style. They tend to be known to do one thing. What I love to find is when somebody's taken that concept and not just, well, basically twisted it or done something or brought in a new take on it, you know, for an existing monster. Or I'm equally happy for somebody who's created something new. That's cool as well. That does something new, perhaps. But the one I'm thinking of is Dimensional Shamblers, which are great monsters. You know, they're really kind of useful if you want to disappear someone or something very quickly. But they do tend to be just used to be like, you know, oh, a dimensional shambler appears and then disappears, taking either a PC, an NPC, or a tome or something with them. And that's the end. And so they kind of, you know, it would be great to see that expanded and like, well, you know, what are they doing with all the things that they take? Where do they go? What do they do? Why are they taking it? Why are they happy to serve a wizard in this way and do that? Or have they got an ulterior motive? Maybe they do something else. Maybe this is one form of the dimensional shambler. Maybe they're like ants, you know, that this is what the cosmic magpie version of the dimensional shambler does. He goes around the universe collecting things because he thinks they're shiny and cool. But maybe there's a different dimensional shambler that is the one that, I don't know, cleans Avathoth's hair, and it's some sort of parasite thing. I don't know. I'm just making it up now. But what I'm just trying to illustrate that, you know, we know dimensional shamblers tend to do one thing. Wouldn't it be cool if they did something other than that as well? Or if we could twist what they do into it, it having the result of something else, perhaps. Are they trying to change history? Are they trying to change time by removing things out of, you know, reality or out of our plane of existence? Are they altering the timeline? Perhaps there is some grand jigsaw that they are trying to build that will change the course of events. Yeah, that would be an interesting take on things. Mm. You know, maybe they are secretly like the Yithians, and they're more, you know, but rather than observers of time, they are actually trying to manipulate things. Maybe they're just trying to build a big kind of Lego house, and all these books are just being used as bricks in this massive dimensional shambler house on some planet.
And the people are the mortar.
And the people are the mortar. You know, I don't know, you know, but, you know, like why are they doing it?
I do like Meccano kits, you know.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, they're a really cool monster, and they do seem to get a little bit of short shrift in terms of they don't get used. You know, we don't tend to think more about, well, what, why, or what could they, or why should this happen, or whatever. They're very convenient utility monsters, and that's just fine. There's not a problem with that. But you know, if you want to do something different with them, then that would be really cool, wouldn't it? I think.
Yeah, I love the magpie model. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, one could actually even look at the Demogorgon from first season Stranger Things as an interpretation of Dimensional Shambler.
Isn't it really, though?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it really, yeah. Really just like one, yeah? And, you know, but in the TV program, that's got a purpose. We don't really know what the purpose is. I mean, it seems to be just going around kind of, you know, abducting people and eating them, and maybe that's all it wants to do.
It's a shark.
But maybe there's more to it than that we haven't seen in the program. And if you've seen season two, then maybe it's just, this is just a foot soldier of something bigger, perhaps, or a different version of the bigger things or smaller things. You know, but, you know, that program does a really good way of, you know, if you just, you know, view that program and view that kind of Demogorgon as a dimensional shambler, and just retrace that back to the game and think, well, okay, I've already thought about it differently. I've already thought about it doing something different than what it's classically presented as. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good example, Dan. It's just, you know, some slightly parallel thinking to kind of, you know, shake up your game a little bit, perhaps.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And even just the idea of a different description of it appearing rather than it just kind of, you know, voops through the air and there it is. You know, it actually tears through a membrane out of physical space, like a wall or something. And, you know, it just gives it a bit of a more horrific thing of, you know, what is this coming through the wall? Why does it look like that? It adds to the description, if nothing else.
And indeed, I mean, the name of the Dimensional Shambler is problematic to some extent. That, I mean, if you saw that approach you, the last thing you would think to call it is a dimensional shambler.
Yeah, right. You might
call it a shambler, or you might call it a giant ant, or whatever it is. So the name is problematic in terms of in scenario names. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's one of those creatures that needs some real variety of names of how people would describe it when they see it. And that will often spin off new ideas or, you know, yeah. why is it called the walking ant or why is, you know, what, I don't know. It could be, it's almost like, you know, the film Mimic, that kind of giant cockroach thing.
Yeah.
I mean, right. Not far away from the kind of idea, is it, to some degree? But, yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot you could do with a dimensional shambler, perhaps.
I like how you said it comes through walls like the Demogorgon does, Dan, but it, for some reason when you said that, it just in my head clicked that this thing comes through people in the same manner.
Oh yeah.
And great. Then the people disappear because when he goes back away, he takes what little remains of them with him. Like he does.
Yeah, sure.
The room.
He closes the door and that person is just gone.
Gone.
It only ever appears inside someone, so every time one appears, it just blasts.
Gone.
Right.
I mean, that seems so obvious now, right?
That's great.
Yeah. I like that. That's a bad day.
And like Mike has said, they've always kind of, I mean, the sound of them is innocuous, you know, a dimensional shambler. Oh, it's going to shamble after me.
Right.
Like an old time zombie is the way you think of
it. That's or, it. But
I run away.
Yeah.
Understated name.
But then even when they do anything, typically all they do is, like Mike says, they show up and they grab you and they disappear and that's fucking end of it. There's nothing left. So it's nice to think of it out of the bag. I think it'd be cool if it popped in and exploded somebody and then tried to explode somebody else.
Okay, yeah, here's a scenario set up for you. You're contacted to kind of, you know, look into the, well, no, you've been getting letters from a colleague who's, maybe a field, biologist or zoologist who's out in the middle of somewhere out on their own. And they're a specialist, you know, in ants, let's say. And you keep getting these reports back about the ants that they're watching and the ants are building this hive and they're doing these strange things. And they are quite an unusual species of ants. You know, hopefully they're going to be named after this researcher or something. He's getting all excited. And, eventually, you know, the letters stop coming or something or he invites you over to come and see the ant nest and you get there eventually. And it's actually not ants. It's dimensional shamblers are all. Building something in the middle of the desert and
nice. He's
watching them and in his madness has just decided that these are just big ants.
Bam!
I love that.
That's cool. You could use that setup for damn near anything though. That's brilliant.
Well, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like we have a bee problem. It's a serious bee problem, man. I don't know what to do. I mean, these things are huge. For some reason they murdering livestock. I don't get it.
All right, cool.
Yeah, cool. I was thinking recently about having seen Annihilation. I'm not going to give spoilers, but I can't seem to stop thinking about that movie. But alien intelligences and sort of the thing that is very cosmic horror to have the intent of the other or the alien be incomprehensible and sort of innocuous, just kind of to doing its thing. That the shamblers could be studying humanity. They're just very sloppy about putting people back. So, you know, they take people away, interrogate them and then, them back.
I love that idea from Annihilation where you have previous without, you know, I'm trying to not spoiler anything here because I've not seen the film, but I've read the books. You have that kind of plot device where you have kind of research teams that have gone into this area, but then they have they've disappeared, but then they reappear somewhere completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether with or without their memory or certain effects having happened to them. And that's kind of cool. You know, the dimensional shambler does actually always put back what it said, but it just gets confused. It never puts them back where it started. You know, so you have people turn up in Australia or books turn up, you know, where they shouldn't be.
Or it could be even just the fact that a dimensional shambler is obviously not from our dimension. And so maybe things work differently in its plane. And so what it does to us, it doesn't do the same to themselves. So whenever, you know, it's doing to each other what it does to us, but to us, it just, you know, murders us and takes us away. But when they do it to each other, it's like, oh, look, we're being careful. You know, maybe just completely different rule set involved.
Yeah. Our biology just can't cope.
Yeah, they're thinking, okay, well, we're doing this scientifically, but for some reason, these guys are so goddamn brittle. They just fall apart everywhere. Nothing we can do will actually keep them in one piece. So we got to go get more. Because they're interesting.
Need a bigger sample size.
Yeah, we need a bigger sample size, guys.
What if dimensional shamblers are basically, in reality, these kind of microscopic amoebas that basically are cleaning, like I said, the hair of Azathoth. You know, they're going around and then they're jumping around and they are just like on like a giant, you know, like a whale or a shark or these little cleaning fish. What if they're just like that on the cosmic level, you know, and we just, you know, and when we think about all the important things that they're taking from us or doing actually just means nothing, you know, that just means nothing at all because they're just, you know, these little more than parasites, you know, in the cosmic level of skin things. And humanity is less than that to them, you know. It's
There's a scene from one of the Culture novels by Ian M. Banks where a particular character, he gets flung out of an atmosphere and he just freezes in outer space and he just floats off. Floats on indefinitely, to such an extent that the galaxy actually rotates back around at, like 20,000 years later. And the same like ancient, eternal, sentient, like planet thing actually comes back around like 20,000 years later and finds this guy floating who he knew 20,000 years ago. And he's like, oh, that doesn't work that way for you, does it? Like you're dead. It's kind of like that. Well, maybe they're like you said, the amoeba that go out and just kind of pick up these little anomalies, and we're just a weird anomaly that it's found, and it's just trying to cleanse it, you know, from the from the landscape essentially.
Yeah. Have you seen the Adjustment Bureau film, which has got that kind of similar concept of keep this agency in the background, kind of changing things to make things. Maybe they're just this kind of, you know, cosmic version of this. Yeah. The Adjustment Bureau. I don't know. Yeah. I like that math. That's cool.
Yeah. I like the janitorial, cosmic horror, you know, maintenance.
I like it. It's for me, it's always more interesting because I don't think that we're meant to understand it. And we keep, whenever we do monsters, we always try and put it in context of ourselves or something like that. So it's always nice to think like wholly out of the box to try and figure out motivations or just to straight up give up on that and say, okay, we have no idea why it's doing it, but then try and find some plausible backstory, whether or not the players ever end up finding out what that is or not.
Well, you only have to worry as far as what the players are going to know or find out.
Right.
And if ultimately humanity cannot know or will never comprehend, then you don't have to worry that far. You just have to present the players with enough kind of blind avenues that they have to just draw their own conclusion and go like, we don't know, but but we think it might mean this, but hey, you know, you're never going to find out whether that's right or wrong. And that's all you have to worry about as long as, you know, you're presenting something for the players to, react to or instigate them or, you know,
I think it's good to remember that these are not static as we see them on page as well. So they might have individual motivations. So there may be anomalies within a group as well. So you might have a dimensional shambler that doesn't act like a dimensional shambler at all because he's a freaking weirdo. And the other dimensional shamblers know that guy's a weirdo. You know what I mean? He does his own thing. So he doesn't grab people. He moves in with them. You know what I mean? And he stays around. And now you have like this strange shambler-esque poltergeist situation. You know, I mean, it's always nice to imagine that there's always an anomaly within the whole, so that when you're playing it with players, you can always throw that one anomaly in every once in a while. So if you're always fighting, you know, whatever, if it's always the Shan, then you know, they always attack us this way. Well, then you have Shan and it does something completely different that they don't ever do. And you just treat them like it's a different monster with the same description if need be. And that way you can just keep them on their toes. So they're not sure what in the hell is actually going on.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that was a lot of fun. I'm really glad we got to the monster part.
Yeah.
I love doing those. Those are so much fun. We need to do those more often.
Mike, thanks so much for, for doing this again. It's been too long, and it's always so much fun to chat with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, guys. It's always a pleasure. And, it's been very good, very good fun. And, thank you. And thanks to listeners for putting up with me again.
We want to hear from our listeners. We have lots of ways you can reach out to us, including ones that we now actually check.
Yeah. God, that's right. I didn't even think about how we had to say this now.
For the complete list, check our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is now mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as our phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions. We mean it. Send us your feedback and your topic ideas. Send us your tired and your poor, or join a discussion. Record a liner. Tell us who you are and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/140.
Thanks for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.
Oh, and friend of the show, Matt Puccio, has released a PDF on the Miskatonic repository called Light in Darkness. Nope, it's called A Light in Darkness. Don't forget the article. It's a dark survival horror scenario by Call of Cthulhu. No, Jesus.
Nancy, do you want me to read this?
Oh, man.
No edits, huh? Go right through. Don't fuck it up.
I so deserve that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Let's do a count just to synchronize all these recordings like to 10.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Do we want a 3 count to 10?
A 3 count to 10? What in the fuck are you talking about?
You want to go 3, 2,
when to
one.
Start?
You mean count and to 30?
Then we start counting.
Should we? How do you want to handle this, Chad?
We do this in hexadecimal.
Zero.
Ready? Start counting with me, everybody, to 10. 1.
1.
2.
2.
3.
3.
4. 5.
5.
6.
6. 6.
7.
7.
8.
8.
8.
9.
9.
9.
10.
10. I love it. It's like a little Sesame Street moment.
It's so great. John just gets progressively worse as we go on.
You know, because I feel like I'm trying to keep cadence with what I'm hearing, but clearly I'm not hearing you guys in live time, so I can't wait for the hearing. I just got to go.
You were a lot closer this time than you were last.
I will, because I was trying to preemptively say the number, and from my perspective, I was saying the number first, and then you guys were following me.
You should have been saying the number when we were saying the previous number, and then you might have been on point.
All of this is going to be in the show.
Great.
Every single bit of this conversation is live.
Miskatonic University, episode 140, brought to you by the number 10.
Yesterday was our anniversary.
Oh, we should do something about that.
When?
Yesterday.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, that's it was awesome. In my Google Calendar. It was...
Wait, turn your recorders on. I don't... just shut up. Shut up, everyone. Turn your recorders on.
Hang on, I gotta...
Right, hold on. I gotta plug it back in.
I gotta get it out of storage mode and get it back.
All the spontaneity is draining out of our ears. In other news, Dan, do you have an announcement?
Yeah,
Now I'm recording. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't want to let you keep going while it wasn't on, so I thought I'd interrupt.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hey, Dan, do you have an announcement of some kind?
Yeah, I was looking at my calendar for an appointment for earlier today and just happened to notice that yesterday, March 7th, was the anniversary of our first episode dropping. So happy anniversary, guys.
Wow. What number is that?
Full 5 years, right?
Yeah, it was 2012.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Crap.
So yeah, it is officially 5 years.
Yeah. We're all contemplating our own mortality now.
It's that, or is it 6 years?
No, it's five. So count with me now. Let's all count at the same time. No.
Okay. Yeah. So 12 plus six is 18.
No, but but you don't start at 1 year. So you go, you start at 13. 2012, and then you start with your fingers. You go 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's 6 years. Wait a minute. 2012.
Yeah. 13, I mean, 14, 15, 16, 17. John got it right, I think.
6 years.
No fucking way. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know why?
I'm a little freaked out.
The show is older than my daughter, because I remember us talking about when my daughter was born.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm shocked that it's 6 years and that John was right.
You wear that albatross now.
I am. I was shame. I was math shaming you. That's horrible.
I was too. Let's use fingers and toes, and you got all the way to six. Non-Euclidean toes.
How did we go from five to six without me? I mean, I could have sworn this was 5 years. Six years for
you, right?
True, you weren't part of it at the beginning, so technically it was kind of five for you.
Yeah.
Well,
six for us.
No, but it was only like 2 months into the whole run, dude. I was there the first year, you jerks. I know I'm still the freshman, but you know. Huh?
Wow.
Crazy.
Oh man. 6 years.
Six years.
6 years is a long time. I was just thinking back to where I started with this. I was in the like entryway of my house. I was married. I had animals. I don't have any of that now.
This is
I don't know the unpleasant side of nostalgia.
I had animals.
Shows outlasted my goldfish.
I was living in D.C. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, you were in D.C.?
Yep.
Yeah.
Dan was at the crap job?
Yeah.
Machine shop. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was at the machine shop. And
John was just John. We don't know what the hell John does.
He didn't have kids. Wait, did he have kids?
He had one. Yeah.
Cole.
Yep. Oh, you did have Cole. It was Celia's Cecilia or Sicilian. No.
Celia.
You had it right the first time. Celia.
Celia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, congratulations, guys. Happy birthday.
Happy
anniversary.
Six years. I'm just freaking out.
Yeah.
Well, another 12 years and we can vote.
They'll let podcasts vote after 18 years.